Good evening, Michael Cohen with producer Desi Simmons. Tomorrow is the Lansing City Council primary vote. I'll be talking to one of the newcomers in the at-large seat race to find out why voters should pick him instead of the incumbents. And new home construction in Michigan is up, way up from a year ago. I'll talk to the CEO of the Michigan Association of Home Builders to find out how new construction is bucking the lackluster trend of the general housing market. But first, negotiations between the UAW and the Big Three now underway to decide the future of 114,000 auto workers at Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford. To talk about what's likely to be the big points of contention this year, I'm joined by Sean McElinden. He's the chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research. Welcome to the program, Sean.
It's good to be here.
Now, UAW members made some big concessions in 2007 and 2009. How significant were those concessions, and is there any chance they'll be getting some of those wages and benefits back in this year's talks?
When it comes to things like COLA or the jobs bank or maybe even the annual improvement factor, I don't think there's much of a chance those will return to the contractual agreement. I think workers are going to be rewarded in other ways that hopefully will be just as lucrative and pay the payoffs just as big in the years ahead as we recover in the auto industry, and that would be through an enlarged profit-sharing program and other bonus programs.
The federal government barred the UAW from striking when it approved the GM and Chrysler bailouts 2 years ago, and while a strike is possible at Ford, that hasn't happened in decades. What kind of leverage will the union have with these types of restrictions?
Well, they can resist further concessions. Chrysler is already on record as saying they would like to increase the copay for active workers on their health insurance. UAW workers pay somewhere between 5 to 7% of their health care costs, and Chrysler claims that their salary people are paying 33%. All that arbitration or no strike pledge really says is that the union can't strike over improvements to the contract. They can still strike over, demands or by the company to for further concessions like higher health care costs for the worker, the average worker.
And now further concessions, that's an interesting position. In 2010, GM, Ford, and Chrysler combined made over $10 billion. The first 3 months of this year, GM earned over $3 billion, Ford over $2.5 billion, Chrysler earned $116 million. With the fate of automakers now turning around, shouldn't unionized workers benefit from the comeback?
Well, we've got some companies differing in very different ways. I mean, Chrysler is not a profitable company by any means. They did have net earnings of $160 million in the first quarter, but they had a loss in the second quarter. You would say they're not very far still from the edge of the cliff. They're in no position to take any increase in labor costs. And eventually they're going to have to sell either Italian shareholders or U.S. shareholders on the value of the company. So I don't know how you can take Ford profitability and take it over to the Chrysler side and say, we got to obey this pattern. That's not going to work this time. We got to have a formula that's a pattern, but with different outcomes for different companies. Ford is very profitable. Workers know that. They've seen a lot of positive headlines. There's a lot of people in the plants expecting a lot from this agreement. And we expect basically Ford to go last. And maybe they won't make the deadline. We might see it extended. And, you know, Ford may have to pay out a bigger signing bonus, much bigger than what you might see at Chrysler.
Ultimately, when it comes to the negotiations, then there are big differences, you're saying, between the way negotiations unfold for each of the three automakers.
That's correct. I actually believe GM is in the middle position, which is why you're seeing a lot of almost hugging and kissing at the outset of these negotiations. The real issue is hiring, too. In the future, there's a chance to increase the number of hires across the three companies in the next 3 years by 25,000. The union desperately needs that higher count. They need those extra dues-paying members. Obviously, these will be entry workers. I think what's in the card is a better wage rate, maybe a better progression on wages for so-called second-tier workers or entry workers going forward into the future. And that, we have to think about the future of the union as well.
I'm talking to Sean McElinden. He's the chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. UAW head Bob King has said that new hires are coming in at half the pay and they're getting a quote, they're not getting, quote, a living wage. On the other hand, he's also acknowledged that the lower scale is encouraging new jobs. It's hard to say where the union falls in this issue. Are the days of high hourly pay just complete history at this point?
No, no, I don't think they are. I think there's some logic to both sides of the argument. The $14.50 wage rate has allowed a subcompact car to go into production today in Lake Orion, Michigan, a car we could have never dreamt of building in Michigan before, with a very thin margin where labor costs really, really matter. On the other hand, as the economy improves, what looks like a good wage to thousands of people, basically $14.50 an hour is not going to look so good when you want to keep trained, experienced people working in heavy manufacturing. So I expect that wage rate to go up, but not up to the $29 an hour level we see traditional workers get today.
And when it comes to the annual health care costs, as you said, they're substantially lower for certainly for GM and Chrysler workers as compared to typical private sector workers. Do you expect the changes then to be made in the healthcare structure this year?
No, actually, I don't see the companies as being one very large company has told me they don't really see that as a bargaining point they're going to push. Another says they are, and one in the middle isn't really reported out of it. I don't see them as a pressure point. I think there are other things to trade for. It's not a liability on the balance sheet, active worker health, like retiree health was. You know, a big goal for all three companies is to avoid anything on the balance sheet.
Now, the unions then essentially, their position is going to be no further concessions and job retention?
We need job security. You know, we can't go below 114,000 we have now, the core UAW left in these companies. And the best job security is a competitive agreement that allows for not only retention of the jobs we have, but for tens of thousands of new hires. You know, you can't improve the wages and benefits of a worker if he never get hired to begin with in the first place. And that's the trick here, is to get those people into the plants and then in the next, you know, agreement or two, start to improve their benefits and wages once again.
When you see non-unionized plants opening up all over the country, how is the UAW ultimately going to compete with these types of wages and these types of structures?
Well, we've actually seen some hard times now at Toyota and Honda. They didn't lay off any of their permanent people. They did fire thousands of temporary workers, which are a fair-sized proportion of their labor force. They were not treated very well. These are opportunities. What workers in these other companies want to see, too, is a union that understands the business case of its employers and, you know, can prove that it's not a job killer, that it's a productive, growing union that can grow with its companies and make them successful. Otherwise, a lot of workers in these transplants aren't actually interested in the insecurity of the old-fashioned UAW. So if we have a non-contentious, positive agreement that maintains the profitability of these companies going forward here in Detroit, I think that's going to help in organizing those transplants.
When you hear people say that the unions themselves are a detriment to the auto industry, to the American auto industry, do you agree with that general sentiment?
No, like most labor economists, I disagree with that when it comes to, large collections of people and one single employer. It's called collective voice. The union style of organizing work can actually help you manage the labor force. It reduces quit rates. It increases quality. A lot of the bad edges we've seen in the past, I think, have been overblown in recent years. How do you negotiate with 2,000 people individually?
Right.
You know, I mean, as long as we have large-scale plants like this where we have so many people, it's best to operate through their, to talk to their representatives in many, many areas. And many of those aren't even economic. They talk about conditions on the job and between people, and it's good to have a union there to work it out.
Finally, the UAW dues-paying membership has fallen from 1.5 million to 390,000 over the last three decades. How much less effective are union leaders at this point in pursuing the objectives of its members?
Well, we've got to remember, they increased their membership last year, and that's because we've got a comeback on production and sales coming in this industry. So we will be picking up. We estimate here at Center for Automotive Research another 25,000 to 30,000 UAW jobs in the next couple of years. So really about a third of that job loss, by the way, was productivity.
Sean McElinden, he's the chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. Thank you for joining me, Sean.
Sure, no problem.
We'll be back with more. I'm Michael Cohen. You're listening to 1320 WILS.